How's it going, and welcome to episode 41 of On The Wire, proud member of the Pitcher List Podcast Network. Follow the pod on the Twitter at On The Wire Pod. Of course, if you're listening on a platform that allows ratings and reviews, please take a second to let us know what you think. I am Adam Howe. You can follow me on the Twitter at 80grade. That's all spelled out. I'm once again joined by Kevin Hastings, who should be followed himself on the Twitter at HastingKevin. How's December been treating you so far, Kevin? By the time this episode goes out, should be the 26th or so. So the year's almost over. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. Unfortunately, I haven't been drafting enough. I think you have done more DCs now than, and typically you like to joke about how much I draft early in the season, but I've had this crazy work schedule recently where I didn't want to be in any of these slow drafts. Fortunately, I've been checking out the lobby, and we have live 1 minute clock drafts coming up here shortly. Yeah. And probably the week between Christmas and New Year's, I'll be in at least one, if not more, of those.
Yeah, multiple times I've jumped in a room, I've texted you, and the room has filled by the time you've gotten the text. But you're in a room right now waiting for it to fill.
Waiting is actually shrunk a little bit. That was our last episode, which we recorded 2 weeks ago. At that time, we were at 4 out of 15. We made it up to 7 out of 15. It's back down to 6, and that's for the first main event qualifier draft of the season.
One of the first, if not the first, Fab League on NFBC altogether.
Which is why I wanted in, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I know that there's a couple rooms filling up for OCs already as well. If you guys are interested in drafting with Kevin in a Fab League, now's your opportunity. It's filling up fast. That's not actually true. Kevin said they actually had somebody leave the room, which is unfortunate. I saw that earlier today. I'm like, I swear there were 7 in here yesterday. But yeah, so drafting, it's drafting season, no matter what time of year it is, we like to say. And yes, I'm in my third DC right now. I think we're about to enter round 20. So hoping by the time this episode goes out, it'll be much further along, if not finished by the end of the week. Yeah, we are in round 20 right now. But we're not here to talk about our drafts, our DCs. We're here to talk about a lot of really good stuff. And we got not one, but two amazing guests here to join us, talk about some really great things. The type of guests that you typically hear don't need an introduction, which means, of course, they'll get the more impressive introduction. Jeff Zimmerman and Tanner Bell join us to talk about the process, projection analysis, and of course, mining the news. Jeff himself should be followed on the Twitter at Jeff W. Zimmerman and can be found contributing across many outlets, including Rotographs, RotoWire, Baseball HQ, and of course, the Launch Angle podcast. Jeff's trophy chest is full of awards from FSWA, Tout Wars, Labor, and NFBC. Tanner should be followed at SmartFantasyBB on the Twitter, and his extraordinary work can be found at SmartFantasyBaseball.com. Tanner, of course, is the 4th ever overall champion of TGFBI, winning the most recent season and displacing Kevin. And the reason we do not introduce Kevin as the TGFBI champion anymore on this podcast. Jeff, Tanner, thanks you so much for joining us. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing okay tonight. It's just a normal night. It's kind of nice. We got the book out. Didn't have to spend a weekend worrying about it or trying to do anything with that. And everyone else wanted all their player previews for the season. I did some for RotoWire and the Fantasy Baseball magazine. So all that went out this last week. So it's actually like the first time I have nothing besides just writing Fangraphs to do.
Nice.
Yeah. And I'm pretty much the same. I feel a load off. We, like Jeff said, we got the book out, the paperback just came out, and that's the time pressure crunch that I feel. And we got that done. We're starting to get into draft prep and doing some podcasts.
Yeah. Happy to be here. Thanks for coming. And let's get right into it. You guys mentioned the book, and anybody listening is probably very well aware of what it is. But for those stragglers that aren't aware, it's, of course, The Process, Integrating Valuations and Biases into a Winning Fantasy Baseball Formula. If you haven't read the book, go out and get it. You can also follow the Twitter for the book itself, at Fantasy Process. Website is thefantasybaseballprocess.com. So Jeff, let me just start with you on this. Can you just give everybody kind of a brief history of the process or the book itself, why you guys wrote it, what brought you guys together? I'm sure you've gotten tired of talking about this in general, but for my own sake and anybody, any stragglers who aren't quite aware yet, can you give just a brief synopsis on what brought the book to be?
It was really like a weird coming together. It was just like, I was like, hey, I'm looking at doing this. And was there being an interest? And it'd just be more of a change. And then Tanner's like, yeah, I'm interested in it. And then we just started putting together our ideas. And all of it seemed like interesting until it became like the last 10%. It was like the editing and just like really cranking through the end. And it was painful. I'm not going to lie. And then I was trying to get the editors to come through. And we have just some continuous disagreements. Even years later, the pitcher hitter split. We talk about that like constantly. Like if there's a lot of disclaimers in that area, it's because we each wanted our own opinion with it and we both just go at it. So it's a tough concept. It's not an easy one to go through. And it's also just been like with the changes of what's happened through time and how things have changed. And some examples that we go through the book, this is a good example. And we just keep it. And then there's other ones that's like, yeah, this has got to go. It's dated or something. I remember one time we have Mike Trout stealing bases. And it's like, well, that ain't happening anymore. Got to change that example. And so there's a lot of stuff like that where it's like just reading through it this year. Yeah, that's not good. No, that's just how it came to be. And it was tough last year. Like we started getting into it and with everything going on, it's just like, it ain't happening. So we put out the appendix with everyone with the standing gains points and the standings and some of the stuff we worked through because we had a short year and how we'd work through it. So there's that appendix had a lot of information. And this year is like, we cut it, like, I think a third of what it was just because it was like, we don't have to have this partial season and all these other comparisons going on because you couldn't take, you know, the 60 game season and know that those are your RBI limits. You had to look at the year before, but then try to look for any trends in between. So it was tough setting those numbers then. This year, it's just, we'll just go off the previous season because best we have. There's no way we're using 2020 and 2019. Right. It's just too far away.
Yeah, you talk about the kind of butting of heads between the two of you. And we've talked about on this podcast just about co-managing a league, never mind writing a whole book. And Tanner, can you talk a little bit more about, you know, that from your point of view, how easy is it? Was there ever a point where I'd rather just write this book myself?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think our partnership works really well for the most part. But speaking of the co-managing, we wrote the book first and then we've begun to co-manage together. And maybe that's why we're doing so well with that, because we've been through the book together. That was the hardest part. And now the co-managing is pretty straightforward. We know how everybody thinks about certain topics. And so, yeah, we wrote that book first and then we've been playing together. How many editions of the book do we have out? Four, something like that, I think. And we've been playing together the last 2 or 3 years. And we have sections in the book about co-managing as well from the things that we've learned and continue to work on together. So
do either of you guys co-manage any other teams with anybody else? And if so, like how difficult is it to maneuver your way around a different brain in that process?
I co-managed some with Fred Zinke. I had to. I had a family emergency that we dealt with in 2020. So I was like, I needed someone else to, if I just disappeared, that they can manage the team. So all my teams had a co-manager during that time. Mm-hmm. And so Fred and I did decent. And then we had to decide what we were going to do with the winnings, if we're going to keep going on or just pocket it. So we've had a couple other teams since then. Fred and I go to a few different approaches. We probably have a little bit more disagreements on how things go than with Tanner. Like we've hashed everything out with the book. We know, hey, this is what it's going to be. We're going to go with this approach and we're fine with that. And so that's just the one thing that's happened then. It's nice to have another person around. Even this last year, that same medical emergency came up and Tanner had to do my Trout Wars auction. Like I literally sent him my values and it's like, good luck. And I remember at some point in the middle of it, it's like, all right, good job. Just like, I will tell you, got me a great pitching staff. That thing freaking rolled. I had to trade most of it off for some steals, but otherwise it was rolling.
Yeah, it's nice. You guys obviously wrote a book together and been doing it for a couple of years. So obviously you have some idea of the inner workings of each other. So I'm sure that helps out. Yeah. The only team I co-manage is a three sport league, and it's more of a, all right, I'll do baseball, you do the football league, and we'll, you know, do whatever we're going to do with the basketball league. So it's not so much that we're co-managing. We're just like divvying up the responsibilities. So knowing your co-manager and doing it for a whole season, I think obviously goes a long way.
Yeah, it was interesting because in TGFBI, we drafted out of the same spot. Like, it started that way. And so we had worked through our rankings for a couple of months, and our drafts were like eerily similar to begin with because we were going off the same rankings. And I remember at some point during the season, I look and I finally said, the heck with Bieber. I'm just like, all right, he's not going to play. I'll drop him. And I went to look to who else it was, and it was Tanner and one other person were the ones that dropped him. And I was like, oh my God, I didn't even talk to him about it. It was just like, we both just were fed up with him and had to move on. So it was just like, yeah, on the same wavelength. I think the one thing that Tanner does a lot better than I do is when to drop people. Like a lot of times I'm a little too willing to move on. He's like, ah, give him another month. And I remember Mountcastle was one I was looking at dropping, and he's like, ah, you need to hold on to him. He'll get it going. And thank God I did.
Can you guys talk a little bit about, you know, like you said, you have four editions of the book. What can our listeners, what should they be expecting from the editions that you make every year or when those editions come out? So Tanner, like specifically the 2022 update, is there anything specific that, for lack of a better way of putting it, is like worth their time to go and get that update?
Yeah, I would first say, if you're a new reader and you haven't read the book, there's not really a reason to go back and buy the old ones. The latest and greatest is really the last one you would need to read. If you are someone that's been following along and has read a couple of the other previous versions, we do, core of the book stays the same every year, but we add new studies and we really go cover to cover and figure out what needs updating for that year. So there's a lot of little studies, little tables that we go through and we update for what's been relevant to that story or study in the last year and update the numbers and the tables, that kind of thing. And then we usually have time for a couple of new bigger studies each year as well that get layered into the book as well. So for 2022, this last year, we were fortunate enough to have Phil Dussault write the foreword. So he talks a little bit in there about, he's read the book before and used some of the ideas that Jeff and I have talked about. And then I think the other thing that I think is pretty interesting is we do an analysis of Phil's work last year, his amazing performance. I think there's some pretty unique thoughts in there. We have a new section about playing for money, some ideas about how to get started and try to be competitive, make money doing it. And we talk a little bit more about Jeff and I's partnership, how that works, even down to some of the finer details like the spreadsheet that we use to co-manage our teams. What's in that? What does it do? How do we make it work? And then really there's a lot of new data in the back in those appendixes that Jeff referenced. So we put all the main league type average standings. We have all the standings, gains, points, calculations you would need for the big, more popular formats like the NFBC main event, online championship, draft champions, AL only, NL only, that kind of stuff. And then there's like new projections in there. We have Steamers projections and all that data just gets updated as well.
Yeah. So make sure that if that's something that you're interested in, of course, go out and get it. Check out the fantasybaseballprocess.com and you can find links on grabbing that as well. Kevin, you've been using or reading the book for a while now. And as Tanner, as you mentioned, you did the foreword with Phil Dussault and all in his success. I also noticed on the website, there's all these people saying really good things about it. Kevin, go ahead and gush about what you find useful or what you found useful of the book in your success as a reigning, a TGFBI champion yourself. I'm going through this list. I'm like, of course, Clay Link wrote a blurb about it. We have another TGFBI champion as well. So I'm like, got to have Kevin's take on this as well.
Yeah, I think what's funny, I remember right as the season ended, I sent you a message, Adam, and say I'd like to think that Tanner Bell's new bio isn't co-author of the process. It's unseated Kevin Hastings. <as champion. laughs> But no, yeah, I love the process. And what I love about it is it takes a lot of ideas I've had in the past, and it explains them more clearly. So even though it's some stuff that I have thought and believed before, it makes it easier. Breaking down your projections to a per plate appearance or per at-bat basis for when you're changing projections, right? Not just giving a guy a bump in stolen bases because you think you should, that type of thing. I have firmly believed that for a long time, and this just, their studies that they put it in black and white in front of you just reinforces that. The appendix that Jeff referred to that they did after the 2020 season, because there wasn't a much to go on, all I did that year was look at the appendix that they put out. I didn't go back and reread the book, which is why I'm having such a great time this year, because I started back at the beginning with the 2022 version. And it actually brings up a question I have, because as I'm going through it and remembering some of the things that's been there in the past and seeing some of the new stuff that's in there, what one of the things that caught my eye as I'm taking my notes going through it is, you know, not to change your player values based on the way your league mates act. For instance, my league pushes up pitching, that means there should be value elsewhere, I think is the general gist of what you guys say. So my question is, when this starts happening typically in NFBC drafts in March with starting pitching, and maybe this year with closers as well, does that mean we're going hitters early as far as you guys are concerned?
I'll start with it. I think in our one draft that we're working through, we're just doing a draft and hold really slow. It finally filled. We picked up for like the slowest one possible just because that's what we needed, especially since we're talking to each other. But for us, I think we found that there's like this nice middle ground, but at around like round 6 through 10, that there's some really nice pitching in that area that you can get some hitters early. And I don't mind like one of the top guys. Like if Cole falls, he's fine with me. Some people disagree with that. I mean, you can go off of what his talent is, but there's a few of them that are really going to throw the innings and beat you at the top. But then there's a second tier. I'll kind of get like the last one of them. And then there's just a bunch of guys to take a chance on. And those are the ones I keep talking about, that if I was in an auction, I would just grab like six of them and then just get a couple of closers. Cause it's like the problem with the draft always is like, oh, they're all going in three rounds and I want six of them. I can't do this. It's just the numbers are impossible. So you have to get it to work out, or if you can find some later or not. But no, it's just like in the auction, there's just a whole grouping in there. So we don't know exactly, like you can pick them apart. But if you end up just getting six of those guys, you're going to have a nice little base and you can work with the rest of it. As for the closers, right now it's interesting, and we'll have to see how it goes, but we don't have everyone signed. There's a lot of teams that are just going to, it's going to clear up. But the problem is we're not going to get anything to clear up for 2 months. So everyone's going to be drafting. They're going to want their closers. We're not going to know what it is. And then everyone's going to re-sign again. And then the draft's going to look completely different. Like we're going to know, do the Royals, did they sign someone and bring someone in? Did the Rockies sign someone and bring someone in? There's all these ones that there's a chance for them to bring someone in. And we just don't know yet. So I think people are like, they want at least one of these guys, and then they don't care after that. And it's if with everyone kind of doing the NFBC ones, is they're going for the overall, at least with the 150s, the 15 teamers. The 50s are more of the standalone. There is an overall component, but I think what three teams get like money or a free team or something like that. But they're generally just a standalone. But yeah, those 15 teamers with the overall, people are going at those with kind of different approaches, but they still need to have some saves.
I think if going back to the theory and the root of your question, I'm a big spreadsheet guy. I run everything through a spreadsheet and it tells me this is what a player's worth. And I think that's important to do because you need to know how far you're deviating from these theoretical values. And yes, every league is going to have something that gets pushed up. But I think you need that anchor that's telling you how far you're reaching. And at some point, it doesn't make sense to reach into absurd levels. I do think that what is hard to quantify when you're doing like these NFBC drafts is that overall aspect, like Jeff was talking about. And because when you run these standings, gains, points, values, and whatnot, you're calculating the value for that player for your league. But as I was thinking about this, it would be very difficult and very hard to try to also quantify the value in the overall. And that's why you see the scarce things get pushed up there. People are playing that higher level game a little bit. And if you do want to play that higher level game, to some extent, you do have to keep up with the Joneses and try to get the starting pitching, get the speed, get the saves. But the problem is, you, like Jeff was saying, you only have so many draft picks to do all this with. So something has to give. But I think you need to keep balance in your decision making and have that anchor of what the values are telling you, so that how badly you're pushing and how much danger you might be getting into by getting out of balance.
So Tanner, you mentioned it a couple of times, so I want you to just elaborate a little bit on exactly what SGP is, and you know, why it's important, why you've mentioned it so many times, and why people should be paying more attention to it.
Yeah, so SGP stands for standings game points, and it's at its core, it's a system for ranking rotisserie players. And it exists because it's hard if you have to compare a 280, 20 home run hitter to a 240, 35 home run hitter. Like, how do you actually decide which of those statistics is more valuable? And this is a mathematical system that uses league standings to try to approximate and help you make those decisions and figure out this player is worth $17, this player is worth $15, so that you can then, you know, kind of use it for decision making throughout the draft. And I don't know how much detail to go into, but it, as I mentioned, it looks at the standings. So just as a real quick hypothetical example, if you had the home run category and you had a first place team had 300 home runs, second place team had 290, third place team 280, that you could see there's like a clean 10 home run jump to move up one spot in the standings. It's never that simple, and there's instructions on how to calculate all this out. But once you know that it takes 10 home runs to move up one spot in the standings, you could figure that out for the other categories. And you can use that then to calculate the values for somebody. So just to maybe put some more examples to it, that it, for somebody that may not be familiar, like last year's main event for NFBC, the standings gains points to move up one spot in each category was like 14 runs, six homers, 14 RBI, four steals, and about 1 point in batting average. So each one of those things would count as one standings gains points. And if you go through and assign how many each player standings gains points is worth, and then you start multiplying it by league budget and all that, you can get to dollar values, or you don't have to go all the way to dollar values, and you can keep it just at this player is worth 18 standings gains points, this player is worth 17, and you can use it to make decisions about who to take first and whatnot. It's not the only valuation system. It's probably the most popular. It's the one that we use, and we discuss it mostly in the book. But there's a couple other ones too out there. There's a Z-score system, and then percentage valuation method is the one that I think Todd Zola uses. And you can Google all these and search how to do them. But I think they're important to help you get that base that I keep harping on, so that when you have some context for if you're making a good decision or a bad decision.
Do you think that this valuation for SGP or standard game points is more valuable depending on the format that you're using, whether it's a draft and hold versus a fab league where you can obviously make those pickups and change what that base is throughout the season? And do you think it's more valuable at the beginning of a draft versus the end of a draft, or vice versa?
Well, I will say one thing is that also with we give the standings is for it to start working, you need to start hitting the minimum. Like, I think 40 stolen base. I don't remember what the number was, but it's, you at least have to have, we'll call it 40 stolen bases. I think it was probably more than that to start moving up in the standings. So like 50 will move you up one, and then 60. So you at least have to hit that minimum. And with the different league types, those minimums change. So that's why you have to use the different standing gains points for each one. With draft and hold, you can't change anything. It's a definitely bigger variation. But the lowers are lower just because there's some teams that just missed on a lot of stuff or quit right away. So that's one of those deals that you have to, it helps with each league. I think it's best to try to get as close as you can to your league type and go with that. The one thing that it does do is it goes with the how the league plays out. Like when we ran a comparison between the Z scores and the standing gains points valuations, we did them both ways. The biggest one is with standing gains points, people push starting pitching. The saves and the, not the saves, the wins and strikeouts are more valuable because it just seems like people hit those two start pitchers and they don't care about whip and ERA. So that's just one of the differences. We've discussed that in the book, that so you know it with your league type. I've got one league at home that saves and holds. I think every, it used to be saves are more spread out, but there's every save is freaking picked up in that league and no holds. It's, even though it's, they get the same category and I just pound the holds and yeah. just pick the best pitchers up. And I get them for nothing because everyone's going for those saves. And I think that they just see like the saves values from a book or something for some other site. And they just value their pitchers that way.
Right.
So it's just figure out what your league is, the different categories with it and go from there. I don't know what else anymore to add.
I would say, I'm trying to think of what your root question was. It was, I know what I want to say. So I think any valuation system has a little bit of a hole in it in that it you can't completely tailor the valuation system to the format. And so what I mean, if you took a draft and hold in which you cannot make any moves and you compare that to an online 12-team championship where you're fabbing like crazy all year long, when you run the dollar values on those players, they're going to come out pretty similar. But you have to keep in mind the bigger picture of what is to come after the draft. So I've been listening to some of your guys' recent podcasts where you're talking about late NFBC draft and hold draft champions picks. The right move there is to take a player that's going to get 450 solid plate appearances. You know that. Whereas in the 12 team where you can fab your life away all season long, you don't really want the Josh Harrison. You want the guy that could be going 25-25 and you want to speculate on him and be able to move on in 3 weeks if you find out he's not going to play. So that can't get encapsulated by a ranking system. So you never want to take the ranking system just purely as gospel. And this guy's $17 and that guy's $16. Sometimes there are other qualitative factors you have to consider as well.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to doing some 12-team fab leagues sooner or later, because I had one DC where I just silly in my late rounds and I obviously took on way too much risk and I picked up too many either rookies or prospects. Some of them may not see the light of day. And so I'm really looking forward to taking that opportunity and bringing them into exactly what you're talking about in the last couple of rounds of a, you know, an OCQ or, you know, 12 team fab league, where I can make more of those risks and not feel so, you know, bad about it.
Exactly.
All right. We're talking a little bit of a fab and in season, this is a fab focused podcast. So I'm curious, all three of you guys, to get your take on how you guys balance out your success in previous seasons and where do you attribute the success more likely? Kevin, I think we probably touched on this over the last year and a half. I'm going to start with you. Like in your success, even going back to your TGFBI championship and any other championships you won last year, in Fab League specifically, what percentage do you attribute your success to your draft prep and draft results versus your Fab activity and like your in-season management, and then also pure luck might have involved? So what do you attribute most?
I think I got to give in-season management a little more weight, at least a little more weight. But the part of the stipulation there is that we talked about this a lot last offseason, and we will again this year as the season approaches. You can prepare yourself for fab in the drafts, looking ahead the last couple of rounds, like you were just talking in a 12 team, like who's somebody that might be getting picked up the second or third week. I'll just grab them now rather than the Josh Harrison, like Tanner said, who in a DC, that would be the pick. But I do think in season carries more weight for me, but knowing that part of the draft prep and draft can contribute to that. I think the luck portion that you brought up can equally affect both. Obviously, you can draft someone and hit on them, and they're awesome. I think, and we talked a little bit about when when Nick joined us and we were talking about why part of the reason I believe in streaming pitchers is because if I'm streaming pitchers, I'm going to get the pitcher that ends up working out for the rest of the season. The guys that aren't streaming pitchers, he's already going to be gone to the guy that streamed him. So there is luck in both portions as well.
And Jeff, I'll push this over to you next. Same question, but I also want to reference the fact that you talked about you're in, you know, other trading leagues as well. So I will throw in how much does trading or good being able to trade, knowing your league mates and whatnot, affect your success in those?
It's really tough. There's some leagues that it's the draft is, it makes things really nice when it's done. But Tanner and I, our main event, that may be the worst draft we ever had. It was straight up. We had 17 rounds, and I think we kept one of the players. There's a 17-round gap where we had one. Robbie Grossman was the only player I think we kept to the end of the season. And we ended up second. So it was just like we ground that team. I mean, we lost to Grom in it. He helped when he was there. But it was a grind. And so I think that's one thing that we can do. And especially if, like, we have some good players, it's just, oh, it just makes things easier. Like, if the draft went good. As for the luck part, there's definitely some to that because sometimes you don't know who's going to get it. I remember one year in the main event, I had J.D. Davis ahead of Aristides Aquino, and I got my J.D. Davis for $5, and Aristides Aquino had 20 home runs in the next week and a half, whatever that insane stretch he had was. I remember Chris List got him, and just, I don't know if he won the league, but it definitely was like a huge difference, and J.D. Davis didn't do anything. But I didn't. It was like, oh, he's hitting for some power, but I didn't think that much about it. As for trading, I'm not a huge trader, but what I'll do is I try to even out. That's the one thing, at least with the trading leagues, is you can find someone like in Tout Wars this last year, I was hurting for steals. So I was looking around, who's leading in steals? I have some extra pitching. Who needs pitching? And found like three people, gave them some offers, see what they wanted to do. And I think I traded Charlie Morton and Freddie Peralta for Whit Merrifield. And it was one of those deals where it was like, I needed some steals really bad. I was dominating pitching. So it was like, all right, I'll lose these guys, add him. And it ended up really helping get me back into first place and then winning the league. I think that's all I really usually make a trade for. It's just to balance my runs and RBIs are out of place, add something like that, or just trade from excess to down. I'm not a huge trader at all. I really don't like the whole process of it, but it's like, when I have it, I'm going to use it and try to balance myself out. There's so many times in like an FBC, it's like, oh my God, I wish I could trade some of these runs off. Like we're just running away with the category, some category like that. Or even in, I hit like four closers and won draft champions this last year. And it's like, okay, great. I've got saves. There's nothing I can do about it. But the deal was, like, they were some of my better pitchers. Like they're helping my ratio. So I just kept adding to it. adding to it. So that if you can't trade them away, it's just like you build the excess, but you just need the other categories. But no, I really grind the in season. In the online championships, I led out all teams in at-bats. So I just ended up getting the most plate appearances. TGFBI, I was around the top five in at-bats. I know Tanner ended up beating me on that. And there's a few other things. Dave McDonald's just a little bit ahead of me. And then Steve Weimer was the only one to beat me in the main event. So it was like in those, I had a top five team in each one of those in at-bats. So I just each week just grind out those runs and RBIs, especially on the hitting side. But the pitching is a little bit more different now. You can't just grind out those innings because there's some really bad pitching, especially in the 15-teamers. You have to balance it a little bit more now. It used to be just throw anyone out. You back more and more away from that the last year or so.
Sure. There's obviously more counting stats to get out of those hitters and those at-bats and whatnot, as opposed to the extra ratio category in the pitching. So like more harm can be done, obviously, with less wrong moves on the pitching category. Are you in the same boat? I'm hearing a lot of pro in-season fab. Jeff alluded to earlier that you tend to want to, you're good at the evaluation in season, like, all right, let's hold on to this guy or what have you. Do you tend to weigh your success similarly in the in-season stuff, or do you put a little bit more emphasis on the draft?
I definitely think in-season is more where you can make a difference. I think the draft is pretty much a level playing field if you just think about how much we all pour over the draft and think about it. Whereas in the in-season management, I do think there is a vast difference in how people think about things, how they approach things, the systems they have. Like, in-season is definitely where I think you can separate yourself. With that said, I think it does matter a little bit on league format. So like in the main event, it was disgusting what we had to try to comb through to find play. Like, it's not easy to do in season there very well. Whereas in the OCs, there's just like unlimited options every week that are semi-reasonable, and you can really piece that together a little bit more. And then I will also, I think, reiterate, I think what Kevin was saying, luck definitely plays a huge part of it. But I think you can also separate yourself a little bit if you put yourself in positions where you can find luck. And I'll give one example that I think helped me a lot in TGFBI. So in that draft, we draft that really in early March when we didn't know who a lot of the closers were going to be. And so I just had a simple strategy of, I think I drafted Hader early on at ADP. And then I laid off closers and then just tried to stack up as many of the speculative ones as I could. I can't remember who all I had, but I know Jake McGee was one of them. And that's a huge reason why I think I was able to win. So I ended up with Hader, McGee, and then I think I fabbed Trevino first or second week of the season. And those three, then I don't have to play the chasing closer game all season long. And then I ended up with really good starters because I was streaming starters. And like Kevin also said, I'm the guy with all the good ones now. And I had so many good starters on my team that it was crazy who I was sitting at times. You have to try to think about what you can do to let luck come your way a little bit.
Yeah. And I like that idea of using your last, I don't know, maybe four or five picks in a draft like that, where you're going to be able to fab in less than a month with speculative ads, specifically closers, especially at that time of year. So I get why you might have done that, because, okay, so it turns out a month later that three of these guys don't work out. Those are my first three fabs. Like, I just drop exactly all three of them within the first fab period or second fab period. And you don't have to spend $300 on Julian Merriweather or anybody else of that nature. Yeah. So that's all great advice as well there. We're going to take a quick break real quick, and we're going to come back, and I have some questions about some projections for you guys. So stick with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, Alex Fast here, and thanks for listening to this podcast on the Pitcher List Podcast Network. If you're a fan, consider supporting all of us by getting a PL Plus subscription, where you're going to get an ad-free website and get access to our Discord, where you can talk to all of our podcast hosts and staff. Plus, you can hang out with our incredible Pitcher List community. It's basically a baseball sanctuary year-round for as low as $8 a month. You can sign up at pitcherlist.com/plus, and you're going to get your first month free with promo code podcast. Also, don't forget to check out everything else we do as well, from YouTube videos, live streams, newsletters, off-season articles, TikToks, breakdowns, over 15 baseball podcasts on our network. We can't stop talking about baseball even during the off-season. So sign up for PL Plus today at pitcherlist.com/plus and use promo code podcast to get your first month free. All right, thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
All right. Now, besides, obviously, with the process with you guys writing that book, you both are active in creating content and giving advice via various means, whether Twitter, Rotographs, your own personal websites, etc. But one series that I noticed, Jeff, you just put out over at Rotographs was your projection accuracy discussion, where you took 14, if I'm not mistaken, 14 different projection systems, and you compared them against what the season final results were. And I'd love for you to give our listeners an overall, what did you get out of that? What did you find, big picture? And I think for any specific details, everybody should be going to check out, I think there's nine episodes, nine editions of that series that you put out, and go read all the specifics in there. But is there certain projections that fared best in each area? What kind of projections were you using? I know you use a mix of, you know, paid versions and, you know, free ones you can find over at Fangraphs on the player pages and what have you. And my biggest question about it is that, in your opinion, you know, how much of your findings do you think is predictive of how they might do for next year's projections as they start trickling out. There's two or three of them out right now, and we'll start seeing more of them come out in the next couple of weeks, but by the end of the year, I'm sure, and then into January.
Yeah, it was... I don't know if I'll do it every year. I'm just going to straight up say that. It is a pain in... trying to be nice right now. Keep it PG, but yeah, it was a pain. We'll leave it at that.
There you go.
It's all the names are misspelled differently and trying to get them to line up and different hyphens and different players. And then Rasball uses this different apostrophe that drives me completely nuts all the time. And Rudy knows about it. There's no loss about it. It's been mentioned multiple times. But so there was a couple of things I wanted to do was to see the big one. Was to see how the playing time compared. That was a big one, like who kind of guessed who was going to do what the most. And then there was another one, which no one had done, was to compare them time-wise. Like I did one, I took the projections the morning TGFBI started drafting. So it was about a month ahead of time. And then I did one Thursday or Friday morning before those last NFBC drafts. So it was about a month apart. And I wanted to see if the playing times were really that much different, and they weren't. I thought there might be. That was just one thing. I wanted to see if some of the projections were going to stay up on it. Some of them fell behind or whatever. So without that, the biggest thing, and really no surprise, is that just anytime you start aggregating the projections, you end up with a better answer. The average almost always won every category, if not just one projection system was like ahead of it, individual. And a lot of times that projection system was ATC, and it's an aggregated one also. So it's one of those deals where it's just the multiples of the brain, multiple people bringing them together is the best way. And I don't think you need to aggregate all nine of them, but I think that there's a way that if you take different people, especially with the playing time, Todd Zola has one way to look at it. The guys at RotoWire has one way to look to see what the playing time is. Jason Martinez at Fangraphs, he runs ours. That's just three people. You kind of even have your own. I think if it'd be great if there was like 100 people doing the playing time. And the biggest thing I look at is like, why are they different? Like a lot of times the variations, I'll just do like a standard deviation on playing time on my own. And just like, why does this one think this guy's only going to get 300 or this one thinks he's going to get 600 and stuff like that's one deal that I've previously done, but I didn't really look so much into it with the study, but it's just, I think the aggregate kind of helps you get in the different ideas of how everything goes. As for projections that really stood out, the bat did really, their playing time, they used the Fangraphs one. I talked to Derek, he made use some kind of aggregate also. He's just not going to guess it. He's, all of his stuff's just like per plate appearance, per inning pitch, stuff like that. So that's an issue. Zips is some of them don't do saves. That's a really tough one to go by. Some of them, like Dan Zaborski, just like with Zips, is like, no. he just refuses to even think about it. So I think that, and I really don't blame him. I know he doesn't have time. Derek Carty with the bat or is the same way. He just doesn't. Like, whatever. Like, this is their talent. I'm not here to guess their role.
Sure.
And I think that's important, is just trying to piece all that together. But no, I think end up using the aggregate. There was the one thing that I found interesting is it was really far off from this season's average. Like obviously they overprojected for last year, like the run scoring, and it went down. But even between them, there was a huge difference. So right now I think I might be wrong. Zips is sort of coming up. It's just Steamer and Masterball Zola right now. Once we get some more, I'll start comparing them. And being like, this one thinks the run environment's going to be here. Like you can, and if you think where the run environment was, any of the ones that guessed that was amazing. There was one time Dakota hit one of them almost dead on, and they were by far the best just because they hit the run environment. I think that's a key but it's tough to know what that run environment is. So I think that's why where the aggregation works the best. Instead of being on one or the other extreme, you just ride with that. So it was definitely an interesting experiment. And the main thing I was just try to get people with the different projection systems and see if you can put them together. I know Tanner kind of has a tool to do that. I have my own way since I have the Fangraphs database. I can work my way through it.
Like you said, there's only those two out right now that I'm aware of, at least. And I know Zips is trickling out as well. Kevin, last year you put out a great article over at PitcherList comparing, I think it was you used Steamer, because at the time, I think that was the only one out at the time as well, to what the ADP was at the time on NFBC. Is there, first of all, are you planning on doing a similar article soon this offseason? And what did you... what kind of did you find as a correlation between the values of certain players to where they were being drafted compared to where the projection was?
Yeah, I plan to do a similar article. Last year, it was only 1 year, but it worked out with nearly every player mentioned in the article. And I don't think that's a victory lap for myself at all. I think it is a victory lap for the projection systems. When I was on Dugout Study Hall a couple of weeks ago, our friend Alexander Chase, he mentioned if everybody follows projections, you would expect to have a mid-pack team if everybody hits 50th percentile. And I get that. The problem is not everybody does use the projections. We think we're smarter in general. We think we're smarter than the projections, but we're not. That's what I take from that article. So the projections end up outperforming ADP. Now, also we're back to Justin Mason's 14 of the 15 players drafted in a league are setting that ADP as well, and 14 of the 15 aren't winning that league. So that's part of it as well. To answer your question, yes, I do plan to do it again, and it just verified to me why there's more things to look at there. It's taken out my biases is what I'm doing, and that's why I look at several of the projection systems. I look for outliers between the different projection systems, and I'm really careful not to use the outliers that I tend to agree with. If I like that player, Steamer's got him hitting 42 home runs, that's not good enough reason. What I should be doing is saying, but everybody else says this, say it's going to be less. So I'm a huge fan. Obviously, I talk about it a lot, and it's to take my biases out is the whole point.
Yeah, you talk about how I like your reference to Alexander Tracy talking about how it's 50th percentile or what have you. But it is interesting to look at projections and seeing these numbers. You'd be like, you hear this all the time, or you either read it or you hear people talking about it on other podcasts. And I'm sure we've said it as well. That seems about right. Like I agree with that projection. Right. Tanner, how do you recommend to your average fantasy baseball player who's not going to make their own projections, maybe isn't even as good at spreadsheets? You talked about yourself as a spreadsheet guy. How do you recommend the average player use these projection systems or projection system in general? Do you think that it's better to pick and choose, going through Jeff's articles and being figuring out this projection did really good with playing time, but this one did really good with ratios, and this one did really good with this other area? Or do you just tend to stay away from altogether and just trust your gut?
Yeah, I kind of view using projections as a little bit of a spectrum. So if I'm just getting started and maybe I'm not good at math, I'm not into spreadsheets really, I would probably just use a well-documented, well-trusted system, something at Fangraphs. We know aggregating projections is better than not, so you probably should use something that aggregates. And if you're just getting started, typical home league, you're probably going to be leaps and bounds ahead of anyone else in your league. If you're using that and they're using whatever comes ranked on the default website that you're drafting out of. If you want to level up a notch, I think almost all the projection systems are going to be very similar in the skill-based portion of the projection, but where you're going to start to make a difference is in the playing time. And we talk a little bit about this in the book. If any projection should be thought of as those two aspects. So the skill-based part of it would be at a real high level, how many home runs per plate appearance is this player going to hit? You can go even further into fly ball rates and launching, all that kind of stuff if you want to. But if per plate appearance, if you broke everything down, that if you looked at different projection systems, they're probably going to be very similar. But when you multiply that by 550 plate appearances or 650, you're going to get a very different answer. So that playing time moves the needle way more than the skill-based stuff. I would start to formulate opinions on where you think playing time is wrong. I think that is where you're better off spending your time than thinking you're going to out-projection a projection system. That's the next thing I would get into. And then leveling up either further from that would be, now I am going to try to out-projection the projection system. I'm going to try to figure out where these things are wrong. And that's where you get things from Jeff's articles, like Mining the News, whatnot. Like, you're looking for changes in skill level, increased fastball velocity, changes in fly ball rate, like batted ball profiles, that kind of stuff, where you think something is not being accounted for properly. Like, you, if you think player's going to hit 50% fly balls now, and he was 50 last year, but 32 years ago, and that's dragging the percentages down, and you want to fully weight it 50% fly ball right now, that's how you're going to get an edge there as well. And I would go across that spectrum and phase up over time as you get more comfortable working with them.
Yeah, I think one of the things with playing time can change the projections, like lineup position. If you're batting first, you're not going to get the RBIs, and the projections may be a little bit slow at moving that around. Like, you notice that the team in spring training is batting this guy leadoff, and he's going to have 100, possibly 100 runs, but only 50 RBIs. You can make that change. But it, like I said, that's not the talent and it's change. That's just the lineup position. And another one is with starting pitching roles. Like, for example, Drew Rasmussen was amazing as a reliever and really mediocre as a starter. So depending on what the projections do and what they think he's going to do, you need to sometimes, as the roles change with starting pitching, you need to come up with your own projections, because a lot of times they middle the road on that. And that's a tough one. That's one thing we did provide in the process, is that Steamer did give us like a starter only projection and a reliever only projection. And it's pretty nuts. It's like DeGrom's like starter projection is better than any reliever projection. he's just amazing. It was just like, okay, you've got it.
You're very good. Okay, we get it.
Yeah. But those are the two that it's not even really their talents change. It's like the playing time. Again, you have to figure out what the team's going to do and what their role is going to be. And it's just pounding that during spring training, finding those guys are going to move up from ninth to first in the lineup. And I think we spotted Robbie Grossman this last year and noticed him. He was batting first and playing every day. And it's like, we got to maybe give him 600 plate appearances. And I think we had him valued as like 11th rounder once we did all that. And it was like he wasn't going in the 11th round, so we were able to just play some ADP chicken. We lost a couple times, but most of the times it paid off.
Yeah, I think that shout out to Mike Curlin, who obviously was doing a lot of work last year in spring training, doing lineup, and obviously you can use Roster Resource over at Fangraphs as well to keep an update on those things throughout the season. But yeah, of course, role and opportunity play a big role, not only in closer talk, but obviously run opportunity, RBI opportunities, and those counting stats and how you're able to count up those plate appearances. You guys talk about how it's important to keep up with these news that come out. And obviously, Jeff, that's what you do throughout, you know, most of the throughout the off season and into the season as well with your Mining the News article. So it wouldn't be a fantasy baseball podcast without some player discussion. So I've listed out a couple of players that you've mentioned in your last 2 months worth of Mining the News. And I'm curious to just get your guys' take on some of the situations that kind of came about in the last, you know, the 2 months. I think your first article of the offseason was November 12th. At least that's as far back as I'm going. And your most recent one came out a couple days ago as we're recording this on the December 16th. So not sure if you'll have another one by the time this pod goes out on the 26th. But
no, there's no news.
Okay. All right. Cool. Yeah. That's the thing. We're in a situation where we could talk about anything right now and put this podcast out 2 weeks from now, and it'll still be relevant because nothing's going to happen.
Well, and that's just, it's like when I did that one, I'm like, I'm just cleaning house. Some of the stuff wasn't like greatly relevant, but it was just like, I'm emptying everything out and I got a nice clean slate and we'll see if anything, there really hasn't been. I'll read some. I think I have 10 articles to look through for stuff, but I'm really have like hope for maybe finding one nugget through 10 articles. Yeah. That's useful.
I'm going to go position by position around the diamond and rotate amongst your guys throughout this podcast to get your take. If Jeff, I'm going to start with you with catcher, but if Tanner, Kevin, you guys have anything to add, by all means, let's get everybody's take on this. On November 12th, mining the news, Jeff, you saw that Joey Bart wasn't guaranteed to be a full-time catcher in San Francisco, even with the retirement of Buster Posey, as referenced from Grant Brisby's article in The Athletic, speculating he may see between 60 and 100 games. On the flip side, you referenced Aaron Rodgers' article over at Royals.com regarding the possibility of prospect MJ Melendez playing close to every day by way of playing multiple positions, including third base, outfield, backup catcher to obviously Sal Perez and Desnick. Curious, what situation are you more likely to latch onto in a two-catcher league, as you specifically said about Joey Bart may not be rosterable in a one catcher league. So in two catcher leagues, which one of these situations are you more likely to latch onto? And then follow up question to that is, of these two, with Melendez currently going with an ADP of 425 and Bart going at 275, which one of them becomes, you know, one catcher league viable first?
I really don't think it really depends on league type is what I'm going to say. If you're in a draft and hold, I think it's Bart. Like, you have to get those plate appearances. Like, Melendez is the Royals, any infield situation they have is a nightmare right now. I think they have three shortstops on the team, like three third base that could be brought up. It's like with Witt, Lopez, and Mondesi are all shortstop. Like, who's going to play where? It's one of these situations. There's just not enough spots, and there's going to be someone at the end of the year that's going to guess this right, like in a draft and hold, and just clean house. And then there's going to be other people that just aren't going to get any plate appearances. So I think like Joey Bart with like a half time is great in a draft and hold. There's catcher gets so bad toward the end that he's just a fine add there. But if I'm in a redraft and Melendez, I think he's a better hitter. And if he's playing DH or moving around the field or being the backup catcher, he's one I'm going to take a chance on. And if he's just not up and not playing, I can just drop him and move on. So I think like in a one catcher, Melendez is going to be the one that could be end up being viable. But that it just has to be a redraft. You have to be able to drop him if he just doesn't get called up.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a common question. And a couple of these questions is, how do you balance out the Melendez could play every day comment versus the Joey Bart, who you already know is going to at least be starting at the major league level, may not see as many plate appearances as you were hoping with the retirement of Posey. And that it's obviously difficult, I think, to look at Melendez and be like, your eyes are already wide because of what he did last year in the minors at a high level. And then the fact that you see the idea that once he comes up, there's a possibility he's not just a backup catcher. They find ways to get him into the lineup 6 out of 7 days or 5 out of 7 days. And then he becomes that much more, you know, viable, like you said, in a one catcher league, if that happens to be the case. I guess I question, Kevin, you talked about this last week on our last pod. You basically said everything Jeff said about there's too many mouths to feed on the Royals team. And Melendez kind of fits into that same boat.
Yeah, I keep hearing this and I'd love to see it. He had an awesome 2021. It would be great to see if he can carry that over to the major leagues. But yeah, Jeff's 100% correct. There's too many guys on that infield right now. And that when we start naming guys in the Royals infield, we're not even mentioning Carlos Santana, who probably isn't as bad as he was in the second half. It looks like he was playing through injury. Ryan O'Hearn is still on the 40-man roster. We're not even considering him when we start making Royals lineups as Royals fans, and he's still a part of that team. So as of right now, I don't see where Melendez will fit. I hope he does somewhere, sometime during the season, but I agree with Jeff, everything he said.
All right, Kevin, I'll go to first base with you. On November 30th, mining the news, Jeff referenced The Athletic's Zach Mesial's article regarding the expectation that Bobby Bradley will be the Guardians' starting first baseman, assuming no major changes to the rosters take place before spring training or even during spring training, putting him in a position of guaranteed playing time from the start of the season. Now, on the opposite side of things, talked about Max Muncy's torn UCL in the December 7th edition, referring to Sarah Wexler's article over at Dodgers.com, making his opening day status very much in question. How do you weigh the consistent production Muncy has provided over the past few years, paired with the looming question of playing time compared to Bradley's situation going into the 2022 season? And I mentioned here that currently Max Muncy's ADP in December drafts is still at 117. Bobby Bradley's still at 392, but Muncy's ADP has been steadily, you know, dropping. I guess I'm saying dropping as in it's getting higher in the past 2 weeks.
The number's getting bigger. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. And we're Bradley's slowly climbing up, and we'll see where he ends up in March, obviously. And as a very small sample size, Max Muncy just went at pick 250 in my current DC. I got picked yesterday. So, you know, how do you balance those two things?
This was really interesting to dive into because I went straight to Bobby Bradley. I pay a lot of attention. Lot of attention to the AL Central because I watched nearly every Royals game. And I remember Cleveland fans were really happy about this move when Bradley finally started getting the starts at first base in June. And he took off 8 home runs in the month of June. He's never been a high average guy. He does strike out a lot. And his overall numbers for the season due to that hot start in June didn't look horrible. Now, by not horrible, I'm still talking a 208 batting average. And we don't care about OBP other than how it will in 5x5 rotisserie. I mean, OBP, it can lead to more runs scored, of course, and make good things happen. But as far as the bottom line, the final stats looking back, we don't care. So when you look at what Bobby Bradley did, he ended up, he was a Joey Gallo light. He did have that many home runs. Unfortunately, it was half of it was in June. Steamer for 2022 has him at about that same batting average, a slight improvement, but 27 home runs in 500 plate appearances. If that's the case at ADP compared to Joey Gallo at 194, you mentioned Bobby Bradley going at nearly 400. I'm taking the Joey Gallo light, Bobby Bradley. And that's the direction I started to go with this. And then I saw where you added where Max Muncy has went at least one draft recently. And if he's dropping that far with, because of the injury concern, obviously, we know what it is. And he's trying rest and rehab for a torn UCL. That sounds horrible. But, this is horrible because everything I've talked about so far this season is I'm not taking these risks at early in drafts anymore. But this isn't early in a draft. And why won't he just play first base every day is where I'm going with this, right? If he's going to play first base every day, sure, he has to be able to throw, but not to the extent we're not talking about a pitcher trying rest and rehab for a torn UCL.
We're talking about Albert Pujols.
That's exactly. That's where I'm going. So if I'm getting Max Muncy in the 17th round of a 15-player draft, that is 100% where I'm going, and I am taking that playing time risk, not hoping that it's not a risk at all in this particular situation. Yeah, I just talked in about four circles there, but that you pairing these two players together took me down that hole.
I'll only add one thing is keep an eye on Josh Naylor. He's coming back from his own injury, and if Bradley starts struggling, see if Naylor works his way in at first base. I think that he could have, if he goes at first base, he'll have outfield first base, and in those deeper formats, he might be interesting.
Yeah, he has a little bit of time at first base going into last year. I think in
15 games.
Yeah, so in certain like a Yahoo format, he already had first base eligibility. Though I'm pretty sure I had first base eligibility in Yahoo formats. Yeah. But yeah, so definitely something to keep an eye on there. I like the call out there. All right, we'll move over to second base, Tanner. In the December 16th edition, Jeff quoted Rob Beertemple. Mailbag article on the Athletics. You took notice of the possibility of Tucupita Marcano being the Pirates opening day second baseman, possibly pushing out Michael Chavis, Cole Tucker, any other options that they might have already at the major league level. In, you know, Tanner, in your opinion, what percentage of likelihood are you putting on this and what sort of production would you expect Tucupita if he would get the full season in 2022?
So I have to be fully honest. I had never heard of Tucupita Marcano before this. But I will illustrate what I went through in thinking through this problem. So I looked up his Steamer 600 just to see if this guy were to get roughly a full season. What are we talking about here? And it said 9 homers, 13 steals, 252 batting average. So okay, that could play in a late draft and hold option there. But when I think about the Pirates roster, it seems like they have six guys that could play second base. So I can't possibly think that this is a likely outcome. So I'm going to just name the guys. Cole Tucker has played second base. Kevin Newman has played second base. Michael Chavis, Hoy Park, Rodolfo Castro, like all these guys played second base to some extent last year. And we know we have O'Neill Cruz maybe coming in to play short and suck up playing time there. Couldn't in any right mind put any likelihood that this Tucupita is going to take that job. But the other interesting thing about like reading these articles, what it does do is it puts a player on your radar. So I'm probably never going to forget this name now. And if he does get called up in August, I have a little bit of an advantage on him. I started to build a little bit of knowledge about this guy. And if I see him as a recent call up in the NFBC main event, then I may be thinking, okay, I can pick this guy up now, but not now.
But not now. Yeah. He's going, his ADP is 746. So like he is a last pick in these draft and holds, even in the DCs and this 15 teamers. So he is absolutely free. So if you want to take a flyer, this is the time, and the time will probably continue on as we go. And he's not even fully drafted throughout the DCs that have. So Tanner, I'll start with you in a very similar situation or question regarding a third baseman. On December 7th, Jeff quoted MLB Trade Rumors, Tim Dierks, mentioning that the Phillies had signed Johan Camargo right before the lockout started to a guaranteed contract worth $1.4 million. Now, similar to Marcano's speculation, what chances do you see Camargo winning the starting third base job in Philly? And as Jeff said, because Alec Baum can't play third base, especially with third base not being the, quote, deepest position from a fantasy position, and should managers be taking note here on Camargo's situation?
When I'm thinking about this problem, I'm trying to think bigger picture than just what the current like roster resource or depth chart is going to show. So if you look at that right now, Camargo is the only option for third base right now. But Philly strikes me as a team that's trying, and I don't believe they would enter the season with him as their starter. Like I can't remember exactly, but when I was looking him up, he hasn't really gotten run as a starter intentionally in years. Like he's only been forced into roles when someone's gotten hurt, something like that. And Philly's signed a closer. They've got a starting rotation. The rest of that team's pretty solid. I would not expect they're going to go with him. And I would think that they're going to probably sign some other cheaper option. There's a lot of decent guys out there that could play third base, like Jonathan Villar, Solano, Jed Lowry, Starlin Castro, Kyle Seager. Like, I am not like up on my news of Tuned It All Out because of the lockout, but I could see them just going with a veteran like that with a proven track record that looks acceptable on paper to a fan base, basically.
I'm personally rooting for Kyle Seager to now sign in Texas because that would just be cooler. But if I had to guess, Kyle Seager to Philadelphia to start in third base would be my guess as soon as that can be a thing. I don't think Seager could sign a minor league contract going during the lockout here.
Yeah, looking at Camargo, as I dug into him, he looks like he's going to be like their utility player, like a Josh Harrison type, where if someone struggles or gets hurt at even like second, short, or third, like he's kind of might just plug in there. So I think he's one that I could see like in a 15 team where you roster three or four times during the year, depending if someone gets hurt, but he's not someone that you're going to have every week. But it was just one of those situations where it's like, as the teams are right now, but the deal is like the teams aren't going to be this way. And I think that one key is don't lock yourself into a player's value. Be ready to change as soon as, or at least hopefully whenever there's an agreement signed and we start playing again and players can sign. Just know that all your valuations are going to get turned upside down and just accept that.
Yeah, I think the most interesting part of this news note was that Camargo, he did sign a guarantee contract. So it's not like a minor league contract it was an invitation to spring training or anything like that. He's just a stronger possibility of filling that role, Jeff, like you mentioned, even if it's a utility role at ADP 737, he's at the very end of these drafts that he could be that filler. And if he gets multiple positions eligibility, whether or not he plays in any one position enough to get that, I'm not sure yet, but it's an interesting flyer at this point in the game.
So maybe I'll mention, Jeff and I said we're doing our first draft and hold right now. We're only in round 39. So if you want to ask me again once we get to round pick 750, I may change my mind.
We'll see where we're at. Yeah. Hopefully this pod doesn't go that long where I can actually still ask you that on air, but I'll DM you later. Jeff, we'll move over to shortstop. And on November 12th edition of Mining the News, you noted that the Astros did not plan on moving Alex Bregman back to shortstop, as mentioned by Chandler Rome of the Houston Chronicle. But as a follow-up on December 16th, you noted that Bregman himself told Michael Schwab that he was preparing for the move if needed. Of course, this is all speculation revolving around whether or not prospect Jeremy Peña could end up being the opening day shortstop in Houston. I'd like to compare that possibility with the situation in Philadelphia, once again, with prospect Bryson Stott, who, as you pointed out on November 12th, quoting Todd Zielicki over at Phillies.com, that the Phillies GM, Dave Dombrowski, expects Stott to go into spring training trying to win the starting shortstop job over Didi Gregorius, who obviously struggled last year with some injury issues and what have you. Which of these two do you expect to take and possibly keep a starting job first, whether it be shortstop or any other position in the form of Peña maybe moving to the outfield? And also, who do you think makes a bigger case to start in an NFBC 15 or 12-team roster?
In all fairness, I think Peña is the better player. I think he's more fantasy relevant. I think he could put up 20 home runs and get you 15 steals with a good with a reasonable batting average. He has a little bit of a strikeout issue that could come up, but that's perfectly playable and actually a pretty decent player. I just think the Astros are going to bring someone else in. That's what I'm worried about. If I was in a redraft league right now, if Kevin's fills up, I would take a shot on Peña in the last round. If it fails, you just drop him the first week and pick up someone else. There's going to be someone that you're willing to do. But if you hit on a 2015 guy in the last round, I think that's great. From what I've read from how Stott did in the fall league, I think if he shows any signs of hitting, he's going to be the starting shortstop. The Phillies want that. They need it to move on. And also, there's been some rumors, I don't know how much to believe it, that Gregorius could go over to third base. Like, that situation's so bad. But I think they want Stott. So if you're in a draft and hold or for the guaranteed of probably 450 player appearances, they might hold him back just to get the, depending on what the service time rules are, I don't even know that. I think he's the one more guaranteed to have the time. I think Peña is more of an either or, but it seems like the Astros are willing to give their guys like a shot. So I think I'm interested to see how Peña goes. They might bring in someone besides Diaz just to fill in the infield just for a bit, just as a backup. It's like a $2 million, $3 million backup, maybe bring in Iglesias or something like that, just if Peña doesn't work out.
Yeah, obviously. We saw how Houston took up, you know, Kyle Tucker, took him a little longer to get up than we liked. But then again, Jordan Alvarez came up blaring and they couldn't keep him down. So I think there is a little bit of a mix of how Houston deals with their top prospects, at least on the hitting side. Pitching side in there is a completely different story, of course. All right, Kevin, we'll move the outfield for you. On November 12th edition of Mining the News, there was full of notes from Phillies, including notes from Athletics Matt Gilb saying that the outfielder Matt Vierling would be competing for a starting outfield spot come spring training. Now, Vierling got his cup of coffee playing 34 games and putting up a 324, 364, 479 slash through just 77 plate appearances at the major league level. But with the loss of Andrew McCutchen and Adrubal Herrera, it would seem that there's an obvious hole to fill in the Philadelphia outfield. Over in Chicago, the Cubs brought in Harold Ramirez from the Guardians, as was mentioned in the November 30th edition. Quoting Steve Adams over at MLB Trade Rumors, Ramirez should also be expected to be competing for a starting outfield job with the Cubs, though personally I'd question whether or not he'll find an obvious hole there like we see with the Phillies outfield. Which of these two opportunities do you like more as far as playing time and opportunity to succeed as a late round fantasy dart? Vierling currently going ADP of 638 and Ramirez at 544. So they're in similar range, especially in these deep drafting holes that we're talking about.
Yeah. As far as playing time goes, I if they both were going to get playing time, these both have some appeal as I was taking a look. But if I'm going to bank on playing time right now, I have to lean Harold Ramirez here for the same reasons Jeff just brought up with the Phillies, not the least of which is I can't see any situation where they don't go get at least one free agent outfielder. So that's the problem with Vierling for me is then you got, like we said, we got Bohm moving around. If he gets moved off third, Gregorius moving over to third, all kinds of things could be happening in Philadelphia. And I expect a lot of things to be happening with Philadelphia once this collective bargaining agreement stuff is all worked out. So that, and like you said, there's no guarantee for Harold Ramirez either with the Cubs, but I think there's more there with Harold Ramirez and the way the Cubs have been moving along with their roster over the past season or so. I think he could get some playing time there. And Alexander Chase, who I brought up earlier, our colleague over at Dugout Study Hall, he had an amazing article last week called Fixing Hard Hit Percentage. And I won't go into detail. Go check that out at pitcherlist.com. But when there's a group of really good players and then another name, I go looking at who that is. And we got there. In that article, there's guys like Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Manny Machado, Michael Brantley, Tommy Edman, and Harold Ramirez right there in the middle. So I go take a look at that. There might be something here. And as of right now, I think he gets more playing time in Chicago than Vierling in Philadelphia with what I think is going to happen with both teams. So that's the way I would lean there.
Yeah, I think it's interesting I think we talked about this in the last episode as well, going over to Resets or any other depth charts that you're looking at. And it's really difficult to analyze playing time solely based on that because really a lot of it is throwing darts. A lot of it is trying to fill holes that either exist now but may not exist, as Jeff, as you talked about, may not exist in 2 months, in 3 months, as more dominoes start to fall down. And Ramirez is listed as the fourth outfielder in Chicago right now, but it's so hard to take that. You have to take a lot of that with a grain of salt because the guys who are doing those things, they're doing their best. And obviously they have some insight, but I wouldn't take it as it's definitely not written in stone for sure.
One thing to watch with Ramirez is he's a ground ball guy. Him and Andy Diaz, they hit the ball really hard, but into the ground. If he can raise that launch angle, things could really take off. But I think he's a 55% ground ball rate. So it's something just to watch out. If he actually, they find a way to get for him to get the ball in the air, I think there's some huge improvement for him.
I think you mentioned that, Jeff, in your article about how the Cubs seem to have a program that kind of like focuses on that.
Yeah, it's just one of those, you're digging for anything this time of year, just sure. Try to find some kind of improvement. And that's, like I said, it's something. I was like, there's other players I have got nothing on. I just have to go off the projections and hope for the best.
All right, Tanner, I got one guy, more of a utility role. I'm going to talk about Ryan McMahon with you. So on November 30th, Jeff mentioned by way of Patrick Saunders of the Denver Post that Ryan McMahon may be the in-house replacement at shortstop, as it's unlikely that we'll see Trevor Story back in the Rockies uniform. And whether or not you believe that they're going to go out and fill that hole with a free agent, Rockies are going to Rocky type of thing. In the NFBC, McMahon already has dual eligibility at second base and third base. If there was a quote guarantee, as much as you can guarantee something at the end of December in the middle of a lockout, that McMahon would gain shortstop eligibility within the first month of the season, would that do anything for his fantasy value in your eyes? And what other sort of trickle effect would you expect to see from the other Rockies positional players if we were to see McMahon move to short in a full-time role?
Yeah, Jeff and I have a rule of thumb that we, going full circle here, we add one standing gains point to a player's value if they're dual eligible. With that said, he already is. And we haven't really thought through the problem of if we should, we don't assign more if you're eligible at three positions, if you will. And he already has a pretty valuable set. Like, he can do corner and middle already. So adding short, I don't think is going to get me, it's not going to tip the scales or anything where I, you know, need to have this player. It's nice to have, but my problem with McMahon is I just think he's overvalued, and he even him getting shortstop is not going to make me want to invest in him. He's got a lot of things going against him. He's borderline unplayable outside of Coors. The rest of that lineup is, you know, getting worse this year. And he's also borderline unplayable against left-handed pitching. So if you start to run the scenarios when you can actually use him, he also doesn't steal at all either. So him playing short, that's typically a spot where you need to be trying to get 10 or 12 stolen bases from in your lineup. So there's just a lot of wrinkles there that have me staying away from McMahon at his draft price right now. And what it does for the rest of the lineup, geez, I understand why they're trying to move guys around, but that lineup is just so confusing to me still. I just don't know what they're going to do. Like, they still have 12 outfielders, it seems. I think Jeff and I have talked about this. Like, we think that it's like Crone, Brendan Rodgers, and I'm probably forgetting somebody, but those are the only two that you can probably count on starting every day. And the rest of the outfielders, there's just so much uncertainty. They're probably streaming options when they're home and have like good handed pitchers coming their way. But other than that, I think it's going to be tough to roster them for the full season.
Yeah, personally, I didn't think the shortstop eligibility on McMahon would add anything to his value. To the point that you said specifically, he already had the corner and middle infield. It's not like he was second short eligible like Rodgers is. And if you were to add the third base or add first base, gaining that extra eligibility at corner would be great. But he already had that. And so I hear what you're saying there. All right, let's move on to some pitchers. Jeff, we'll talk about from your December 6th edition. You noted that Michael Lorenzen was guaranteed a rotation spot with the Angels, as noted by Athletic's Sam Blum. How does or should this rotation lock affect his draft value, especially in a draft and holds format? Like we talk about, just looking for that guaranteed playing time or guaranteed role. How much do you buy into Lorenzen's comments about being a different starter than when he broke into the league, as you mentioned in that article?
There was a lot to digest with this. I think that they got him to sign because of it, but he was bad as a reliever last year. Just a 6.5 K per nine. He was walking almost a batter every other inning. And if you look at his numbers from last year, they're eerily almost identical to his career stats as a starter. So he says he's got all these improvements, but why didn't he do them last year? Like, he just completely fell apart and he just is walking everyone. So that's probably even going to get worse. And there's just no way you can roster a 1.38 whip is what he had last year. He's projected for, worse, because they have him starting at a 1.45. That's just a killer for your team. Maybe he mentions all these things he's changed since he originally started. Maybe he wasn't doing some of them while he was while he was in relief. I don't know. So I think he's someone you have to take a shot on. He has to be drafted in every draft and hold. He's going around pick 600. That's probably right. It's just they're bad at that point. The pitchers are. You're just adding anyone you can and just hope that they're not completely horrible. So I think where he's going is fine, but I just don't see there's any huge upside. There's nothing in his past that in the last year or anything that shows that he's an above average pitcher, especially with that walk rate. He has to get that under control. Maybe if he's not walking people in spring training, I'll be interested, but in a redraft format, but he's not someone I'm going to be taking a chance on in those. There's a lot of other pitchers I will.
Yeah, I know that there was, I don't think it was one of your, I forgot where I read it, but he was also very interested in being a two-way player going into this year, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm just curious because of course, of all the teams he signed with, it was the Angels for that opportunity. So I'm curious to see from just a fan perspective, how much of that actually comes to fruition. I can't imagine that it becomes fantasy viable, fantasy relevant per se, but I am curious to see how he does with that, because I know he's been talking about that for a couple of years.
Yeah, it's, we'll see. I wonder if he's going to be like a pinch hitter with some kind of like long, he could be like a mop up man. I think that's what he's going to end up being. It might end up being his best kind of role. I didn't understand any of this, but the Angels need all kinds of starting pitching. So he's probably their number three person right now. I think it is that way, and we'll see how it goes. But yeah, it's just not someone I'm going to spend much draft capital on.
Sure. All right, and we will end it in the bullpen, Kevin. Save the best for last. Of course, I saved the Royals talk for you. Jeff noted on November 30th edition that Josh Stalman never really recovered during his season from his fight with COVID, which Alec Lewis of The Athletic goes into more detail. His disappointing season opened the door to other options, of course, at the back end of games, putting Scott Barlow in the closer chair by season's end. In your opinion, should we expect to see Stalman fight back this spring and bring himself back into the endgame conversation for the Royals? Or do you think Barlow should be considered a reliable back end option for fantasy players because he's been being drafted to such extent, going within the top 200 in most recent?
This is something we're really going to have to monitor in the spring. For right now, I have drafted Scott Barlow as my second closer in a draft and hold. I think that's probably how things start out the season. You might remember last season, I really thought they were going to trade Scott Barlow at the deadline. With where the Royals were going, there was no other reason for them to let him start accumulating saves when going into 2022, he was going to be first year arbitration eligible. And that's still a bit confusing to me, and maybe even worrisome as they may let him go in this offseason. I don't think that's going to happen, but both of these guys were awesome down the stretch. They really were. Since mid-August, Josh Stalman had a 1.35 ERA and 11 holds. And in that time, starting on the same day in mid-August, Scott Barlow had a 1.56 ERA and 10 saves. I think Mike Matheny's just going to roll with that. And they're hoping the Royals can compete much more in 2022. I see that the way I believe that's what Matheny is hoping will be his eighth, ninth inning going forward in 2022.
Do either one of Tanner, Jeff, do either one of you guys feel more comfortable with a Barlow in the top 200 as Kevin said, as your second closer, or taking the flyer on a Stalman coming back and taking over that role?
We have to. We've already bought in. We pulled the Kevin and went ahead and drafted him as our number two. Pick was it? I can't. Tough to tell. The deal also, like, we had really in our draft, it was the 11th round and the closers were coming off hard. We didn't really have an option after him. We were hoping things would go with ADP and it wasn't that way.
I will say in the league where I drafted Barlow, I took Stalman later. That's the case where it's almost like handcuffing a running back.
That was going to be a follow-up question to you guys, is like, how much do you put into handcuffing, especially in a bullpen situation where you're taking flyers on bullpen guys at the end of these drafts or toward the end of these drafts, specifically targeting the backups or the setup man or the guys right behind it that could take over that spot. Same could be said about getting your backup catchers as well. Tanner, do you have a specific mentality in that kind of strategy, or are you just taking the guys that are available?
So rightly or wrongly, the way I think about this problem would be to not try to stack the bullpen. By doing that, I think you're limiting your ceiling. If Barlow has the opportunity to get 35 saves, Stalman has, I can't get 70 by drafting Stalman and Barlow. Whereas if I draft the guy I think is the front runner, and then maybe the backup guy that I think second in another bullpen, I get a little bit of a higher ceiling there. But at the same time, I'm very torn on it because in a DC, I probably just want to get 60, say, like somehow, some way. So I could go either way on it. But maybe if you're thinking overall and you want to try to get 90 saves total in your bullpen, I would try to maybe split them and hope you get lucky.
Yeah, we didn't have the option. It kind of stomach went a little bit earlier than I thought he was. So went in the 31st round and our backup plan was Cole Sulcer. The draft and holds, I've spent a lot of time trying to guess on bullpens and just had it wasted picks where I accept being middle of the pack or toward the bottom in saves. And I'm not going to win the overall if things just don't work out. I'm not going to put a ton of resources into trying to hit the saves when I'm just going to be passing up on everyday hitters or Okay, or what could be end up being decent starters.
I think that January kind of nailed it too. It is the mentality, and we see this in a lot of, especially these earlier drafts, if whether or not you are going for the overall aspect of your league, if you're in a league like that, like a draft champions or what have you, or if you're just trying to, you're focusing solely on winning your league. I think that will change. Obviously, that's going to change a lot of different strategies in your draft, in your draft strategy. And this, I think, wouldn't be an exception to that. All right. I think we've talked about some great players that Jeff focused on a lot of the Mining the News articles. We reference Mining the News plenty, and I know a lot of people do. So if you haven't heard about it before this moment, go check it out. I don't know. Like Jeff, like you said, I'm not sure how often we'll be seeing them until things can actually start getting rolling. Keep an eye on Rotographs and everything that Jeff is doing over there. And of course, Tanner is doing over at his site as well. And Kevin, I'll leave you with the final words, like any other additional words of wisdom that you can provide to those who are doing early drafts and still in the calendar year of 2021 going into the 2022 baseball season.
No, just have fun, because there's nothing I'm adding to any strategy when we have the guys that wrote the book on it here.
You know, trust the process. That's all. Exactly. That's all you had to say. There we go. All right, Jeff, Tanner, thank you so much for taking the time to break, you know, all of this down with us today. Could you remind our listeners where they can follow, listen, read your work moving forward, as well as anything specific you may be working on besides the process itself, because you're done working on that for now for this year, and, you know, how they can keep, what they should be keeping an eye out for?
I'll be writing on Rotographs regularly. We're taking a break here over the holidays. I might get up an article or so coming up here, but we're definitely just taking a break. And then I'll write over at RotoWire this year, probably at least one article, maybe more a week, depending on how much time I have. And then, no, I'm just, follow me on Twitter at Jeff W. Zimmerman. I'll have my opinions there. Some of them everyone will disagree with. But I'm just getting ready to have some fun. I just hope that we can just get a little bit more guideline. I think it's going to be really weird that we're just going to be like, we're going to have this preseason and postseason this year. Not so much, that's not the right wording. It's like, whenever we have guidance for what the season's going to be, that there's just going to be this whole draft season before that and a whole draft season after that. And just get ready for the big change once it occurs.
Yeah, and you can follow me, Tanner, at SmartFantasyBB on Twitter. And I'm an odd analyst. I don't really put out a lot of content, but if the spreadsheet thing interests you and you're maybe interested in learning and exploring more with projections and ranking systems, I have a lot of tools available that I publish on my website that can help you along that path. And then you can check out the process at thefantasybaseballprocess.com.
Yeah, of course, as Tanner mentioned, it's smartfantasybaseball.com as well for his site. And we'll have links to all this stuff in the show description for anybody who just, you know, glossed over what everybody just said and wants a direct link to all of that. So check that out for all the timestamps and all the stuff that we talked about, plus direct links to all that. We will continue to put out episodes every 2 weeks throughout January. So keep a lookout for those incoming and expect us to go back to a weekly episode schedule starting in February and going through the 2022 season. There are other amazing podcasts coming out every day on the Pitcher List Pod's main feed. So please make sure to subscribe to the podcast feed and the Pitcher List Fantasy Baseball feed itself, wherever you listen, and leaving a rating review, of course, as I mentioned before, is always appreciated. You can follow myself on the Twitter at 80grade, all spelled out. Kevin is at HastingKevin. Also make sure to follow at Pitcher List Pods to get updates on every new episode of all the Pitcher List Podcast Network shows and give them all a listen. Thanks so much once again to Jeff Zimmerman and Tanner Bell for joining us. And on behalf of Kevin Hastings, I am Adam Howe. With that, we bid you goodbye.